After nearly 30 years of sound advice.
Yeah, bite the bullet. Don't fix this car anymore.
I mean,
you already got the girl, man. The car did it.
And reliable laughs.
I've come to realize that it's a big, beautiful piece of junk.
We bid farewell to the Tappet Brothers of Car Talk. Help celebrate decades of enjoyment by donating your old piece of junk to NHPR. Find out how at nhpr.org/cardonation.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Violence at a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, makes an impact nationwide, and people in New Hampshire hold vigils to remember the young counter-protester who was killed. Two big insurers commit to the state's Obamacare exchange, and Governor Sununu aims to strengthen animal cruelty laws. Lots of news to unpack this week, and we can't do it without your help. What about these stories do you want to know? What other stories still leave you with questions? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. Here in the studio to answer your questions are three very knowledgeable people: Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, NHPR reporter Casey McDermott, and Kevin Landrigan of the New Hampshire Union Leader. Everybody, thank you very much for being here.
Good morning, Peter.
Thanks for having us.
And just a reminder to our listeners that we do stream a live video of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. You can check that out on NHPR's Facebook page as well as the Facebook page of The Exchange. Again, that is NHPR Exchange, all one word. So let's dive right into the news out of Charlottesville and how it's been making waves across the nation, including here in New Hampshire. Some of this news, of course, very difficult to listen to and hear and watch on television. It's been nearly a week, but it almost feels like it happened just yesterday, given how prominent it's been in every newscast here at NHPR. And vigils took place almost right away, didn't they?
Yeah, they certainly did, and continue to. We're going to have a pretty big demonstration, counter-demonstration in Boston on Saturday by the Boston Free Speech Coalition. They say they're against violence. Folks who opposed what happened in Charlottesville believe they represent some of the same kind of hate speech organizations. So should be a very a lively kind of repeat of what we've seen throughout the week, hopefully without the violence. And Boston PD, which has a lot of experience with this regarding since the marathon bombing, there's going to be no backpacks allowed. It's going to be a very kind of locked down demonstration, and it better be peaceful, the cops say.
No backpacks, no weapons, and
no sticks, nothing.
Must be peaceful. Okay, we've got some tape of Boston Mayor Marty Walsh on issuing a permit for this free speech rally. Let's hear him.
No, I don't. I didn't want them to get a permit, quite honestly, but we also believe in free speech in our country, and I didn't want them to get a permit because I don't think that their message, what I'm hearing, if it's the same group that was certainly in Charlottesville, that message is not wanted here. That message isn't wanted in the United States of America.
So Boston Mayor Marty Walsh talking about the rally coming up. So, Dean, maybe you can weigh in on this. I mean, this
sure.
is, you know, we saw what happened in Charlottesville. People were fighting. One person died. It went badly in one city. Now are other cities going to do, generally speaking, increased scrutiny on future events?
Yeah, this is going to be a big challenge for mayors around the country. This is not an isolated rally. The white supremacy movement and white nationalists have said that they are going to be more actively engaged in pressing their case around the country. They had chosen Charlottesville kind of as an initial ground zero. There had been plans to come back multiple times. You know, a lot of this kind of centered around the idea of cities like New Orleans recently did removing statuary that celebrates the Confederacy. So, you know, this is going to be a challenge because, as we heard Marty Walsh say, there are real kind of First Amendment free speech issues involved in here. At the same time, you want these events to be safe. You don't want violence. We don't want a repeat of what happened in Charlottesville. So it's going to be a challenge. But, you know, there's these you know, the protesters and counter demonstrators, et cetera, you know, there's a real potential there for violence, for things to blow up. And I think it's going to be a real challenge for the police to kind of figure out how to let people in, you know, exercise their right to free speech, but at the same time ensure public safety. So, yeah, these are going to be issues going forward now all over the country. This isn't just going to kind of evaporate over the next couple of weeks.
Well, and speaking of it being an issue that's all over the country, I think one of the things that kind of highlighted that this week was a lot of people were watching this Vice News documentary that was made around Charlottesville, and there was a man who was featured prominently there who identified as a white nationalist, white supremacist, and that kind of central character in that documentary from Charlottesville lives in Keene. And, you know, we've done some reporting on that. Some other local outlets have done some reporting on that. So I think that, you know, to Dean's point, does hit home that, you know, there are people all across the country who hold these beliefs and who are very, you know, passionate about spreading those beliefs all over.
And HPR's Brita Green had a chance to talk with that man from Keene, Christopher Cantwell, who was featured in that Vice documentary. Let's hear a clip of what he had to say to Brita Green.
I don't think I'd really be anxious to have an event in New Hampshire, frankly, because it's like it's a white state. We don't have these problems there.
That was one of several things that he said that really was inflammatory for a lot of folks. And now, according to most recent reports, that he's under some kind of law enforcement scrutiny for his actions in Charlottesville.
Yeah, he certainly is. He had his social media accounts taken down, essentially, and even a private PayPal account that was taken down as well, which he really objected to. He Facebook has banned him, and Instagram has also banned him. Facebook said the profile pages have been removed, as well as a page connected to his podcast. And of course, Cantwell says that Facebook is trying to silence him for his views, and that's against free speech and against his rights to speak.
Well, it's interesting, you know, Keene is often kind of, we talk about Keene in the context of the Free State Movement, which is this movement to get 20,000 people to move to New Hampshire. This has been going on for a long time now, and they've had some success, but perhaps not as much as they had originally intended. And he had been associated with that movement. He had been, on a podcast, but he was too extreme even for them. They essentially kicked him off the podcast, and he now is off with his own podcast. So that was quite startling to see him in that documentary, and it shows you that this is an issue that's not limited just to the South.
Yeah, and like Casey said, I think very well in bringing up Chris's involvement in this. I mean, he's not alone in the views he has, to be sure. I mean, my colleague at WMER, John DeStaso, talked to former Republican State Chairman Jack Kimball, who's a leader in the Rochester 912 movement. And he charged in Charlottesville that the problem was the far-left Antifa group. As he put it, quote, "The white supremacy groups were the ones who filed for the permit, and it was all going well until the arrival of Antifa." He's convinced the person charged with ramming that car into the crowd was going very slowly until people from Black Lives Matter took a bat to the back of his car. Then he stepped on the gas. "I'm convinced he was scared as crap and thought he'd get the crap beat out of him," Kimball said. So these white supremacy groups and this notion that the president enunciated earlier this week that touched off this firestorm, that both groups are to blame for what happened in Charlottesville.
This issue of moral equivalency.
And exactly.
This is actually something that Governor Sununu has explicitly condemmed. He has come out and said there is no...
Well, it took him a few days to do that.
Yeah, but he did eventually say there's no moral equivalency.
And we do have some tape of Governor Sununu. Let's hear what he had to say about this.
It's absolutely disgusting. That kind of racism, you know, this white supremacy stuff, it's just, there's absolutely no place for it. And it's appalling to me that in the year 2017, we're even having this conversation, but unfortunately we do. It's important that everybody step up and make sure that those that would portray such hatred, there's no place for that. Not in Virginia, not in New Hampshire, not anywhere in this country.
That's Governor Chris Sununu speaking about the events in Charlottesville. Casey.
Yeah, I just for the sake of clarification, you know, the governor was very clear and very emphatic in his denunciation of white supremacy and of racism and of the violence that occurred in Charlottesville. I will point out that I think he, like a number of Republican officials, went through a little bit of an evolution in their denunciation of the president's comments this week. Initially, I asked the governor what he thought and actually asked, you know, you specifically named white supremacy and racism as factors here. The president did not. Some of your Republican colleagues have, you know, criticized him for that. How do you respond? And his initial response was that, well, the president's statement condemned it. No matter what the president says, people are going to criticize it. What's most important is kind of what we do moving forward. I think it seems like the turning point for him and for a lot of other Republicans who are a little bit more kind of, you know, walking that fine line between outwardly criticizing the president and, you know, making clear that they do not agree with what happened in Charlottesville this weekend, was that press conference later in the week where the president kind of doubled down on this idea that both sides were almost equally to blame in all of this. And we heard a much clearer denunciation in a Twitter statement that the governor put out after that.
Mm-hmm. We've got one comment here that is worth bringing into the discussion, and then we'll get back more into the sort of political discussion surrounding how politicians are talking about what happened in Charlottesville. This comes from Michael, and Michael says, at the end of the day, as much as you disagree with the content of the speech those Nazi idiots were spouting, they pulled the permits and had a right to be there. Michael here is referring to the fact that the white supremacists did pull permits to be in Charlottesville. And the United Michael continues, in the United States, disagreeing with someone's speech does not give you the right to suppress it with violence. The idea espoused by some that Antifa is somehow like American soldiers on D-Day is both repugnant to many now and insulting to the men and women who fought there. In a weird way, who are more like the Nazis, the Americans who gathered to express their repugnant ideas, or the people who showed up with bats to mask and masks to silence them. So essentially a comment here saying that you can't equate the Antifa, the counter-protesters, with those who were fighting Nazis on D-Day. And that just one more example of people who have a diverse view of what exactly happened in Charlottesville and who is to blame for the violence. Something you've been hearing a lot of, Dean?
Sure, absolutely. And I think, you know, at some level, the question that this issue about, you know, each side kind of pointing fingers at the other, but that's just, it's not going to be resolved. You know, most of this stuff is sort of typically kind of filtered through your notions about sort of the intentions of the other side. And, you know, just sort of sampling cable news, you know, you had sort of predictably, you could sort of predict where people are going to come down upon the kind of, you know, is there a moral equivalence? Is there not a moral equivalence? Was it many sides or is it just one side? I mean, you can really kind of, it was sort of pretty easy to predict in most cases where people were going to land on this. I mean, this is just part of the political debate in the country. It's you know, quite volatile at the moment. It's not the first time in our country we've had this kind of volatility, but it is at a level that we haven't seen in a while.
And is this a part of the overall trend that we're seeing, which is that no actual truth exists here, right? Like there is just there's a side to be taken on either one, truthful or not. I mean, Kevin, you just mentioned someone saying, well, the man accelerated his car into the crowd because there was a Black Lives Matter person behind them with a bat slamming into the car. Like the videos I've seen show no evidence of that. Maybe I've missed something and I will allow for that possibility, but it doesn't seem like that's the case. People seem to be just making stuff up.
Yeah, I think Michael's right about one thing, which is both sides come to that event with an agenda and with very strong views that oppose the other side that is there. And that often spells unrest. But to your point, Peter, there's only one side that caused a death in Charlottesville. And there's no dispute about that. And that's why, back to Dean's point, I think, and why, frankly, that's why the grown-ups in the National Republican Party stepped in here before Governor Sununu came in, such as former presidents George H. and George W. Bush, Mitt Romney, the 2012 Republican nominee, all speaking loudly and strongly that there is no moral equivalence here of what happened. One side was more at wrong, and it was the white supremacist side in Charlottesville. That's what they said. And that's, I think, why you saw a kind of a chorus of people following suit, including Governor Sununu saying, the president's comments were deeply disappointing. There's no moral equivalence between those who espouse racism and hatred and those who stand up against it.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we've been speaking with our guest today about Charlottesville, but we're also going to be talking about new options, or rather options we're going to have on the Obamacare Affordable Care Act exchanges. We'll talk about daycare mandates and their delay, the drug crisis, and, of course, whatever else is on your mind. What does the press miss this week? What haven't you been hearing in the news that you think deserves representation in the public dialogue? Give us a call now, and we'll add your voice to the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. Lots of political reaction, of course, to Charlottesville. What has the congressional delegation been saying? Casey.
Well, I think, you know, as expected, there was a swift denunciation across the board from the all Democratic delegation there of President Trump's comments and just generally the racism and the violence that we've seen in Charlottesville. So I don't think there was necessarily anything out of the ordinary there.
Mm-hmm. What I'm hearing, generally speaking, is that people are very, very quick to denounce the violence that they've seen at the rally. But partisan differences appear when it comes time to decide whether or not President Trump acted appropriately. Dean, are you seeing that?
I mean, certainly that's true. But I think the more interesting place to focus is within the Republican Party itself, and seeing some of the divisions within the party in terms of, you know, how members of Congress and the GOP are responding to President Trump. Some have been more outspoken than others. You know, a lot of these members of Congress, they're on recess right now. They're going to come back in the fall. They've got a big agenda with a debt ceiling and infrastructure and tax reform and health care, all the things we've been talking about now since President Trump was inaugurated. He is their president. Typically, you think of the president as the leader of the GOP. So you would expect there to be a relationship. And so they're kind of in this sort of tough position about they need to work with him. They have to be attentive to their constituencies. And certainly that varies by sort of where you are in the country. But I think it's a real challenge. But yeah, I mean, certainly there are differences between the two parties. But the interesting debate for me is within the GOP itself. You saw a very strong reaction from conservative intellectuals in the party, many of whom were part of the Never Trump movement during the campaign. But you've seen others who are, you know, a little more measured in the response because there's an electoral reality that they're dealing with.
Well, I think what's also going to be most worth watching is, you know, we're having this conversation right now, and you have a lot of prominent Republicans who have stepped up and said, this is wrong. I disagree with the president. The president is wrong. There's no equivalency between racism and white supremacy and the people on the other side who were fighting it. And it's wrong to make that comparison. But this is not the first time that the president has said something that many Republicans themselves have found objectionable and have said they found objectionable and morally wrong, and then, you know, have continued to support him. So I think that that's going to be what's interesting to watch, is we keep having this conversation in the political world and in the media about, is there going to be a turning point? Is there something where people are going to say, okay, this is the end, this is the last straw? But that, it seems like every time there's something that seems to be most objectionable to those who would otherwise be his supporters. Right. A week later, it's all history.
Well, it speaks to the difficult position they're in legislatively. Yeah. I mean, they need to get stuff done separate from whatever the president decides to do, and they certainly need him to sign legislation.
This is the New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup on the Exchange, and we're speaking with Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University, NHPR's Casey McDermott, and Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and, of course, with you. If you've got questions about the week's news, about Charlottesville, Medicaid, daycare rules, the drug crisis, something the press didn't catch, please let us know. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page, where you can watch a live video stream of all of us in the studio right here as we discuss the week's news. It's exciting stuff. After the break, we'll be talking about some of what Governor Sununu has been up to this week, as well as the Obamacare Affordable Care Act exchanges and changes coming that way. This is NHPR's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
after nearly 30 years of sound advice.
Yeah, bite the bullet. Don't fix this car anymore.
I mean, I do.
You already got the girl, man. The car did it.
And reliable laughs.
I've come to realize that it's a big, beautiful piece of junk.
We bid farewell to the Tappet Brothers of Car Talk. Help celebrate decades of enjoyment by donating your old piece of junk to NHPR. Find out how at nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with NHPR reporter Casey McDermott, the union leaders Kevin Landrigan and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU. And it has been a busy week for reporters in New Hampshire. And now is your chance to get some answers to your questions about what's been happening in the Granite State. We'll be discussing daycare, the Manchester VA Medical Center, insurance, of course, we're going to start us off with. But call us if you have questions. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll get back to a caller in a little bit who has a question or comment about the Charlottesville violence. But first, let's talk a little bit about insurance. This week, we learned that both Harvard Pilgrim and Anthem will be in the Affordable Care Act exchanges later this year. Casey, what does this mean for folks who get their insurance through the individual marketplace?
Well, it means that the people who, you know, there might have been some degree of uncertainty about whether Anthem and Harvard Pilgrim, which are two of the largest insurers currently offering individual plans on the marketplace, whether they were going to be in next year. You know, recall just a few weeks ago, we had the insurance commissioner saying that he was operating in a climate of kind of, I think he said, unprecedented uncertainty, which is, you know, a pretty big phrase coming from right. The person in charge of our insurance markets here. So, you know, I think the fact that and at that point, I should also say that that was coming, you know, while there were a lot of talks about what to do to stabilize the markets. I think there's still a lot of kind of questions around what it's going to take to kind of keep prices down and make sure that everything is solvent next year. But there was uncertainty up until this point as to whether Anthem and Harvard Pilgrim were definitely going to be in for 2018. So this means that people who were getting coverage on those plans are good. Another insurer, Ambetter, which also is offering coverage in New Hampshire this year, will still be on next year. It is worth noting that another provider that covers, when I was looking this up earlier this week, I found that I think about 23,000 people are currently insured through Minuteman Health on the individual market. I could be off on that, but those people will have to find another option for 2018 because Minuteman was, they earlier this year had said that they were going to relaunch as a for-profit. They're currently a co-op, but they have since been placed into receivership in the state of Massachusetts. And according to those officials down there, they did not take adequate steps to kind of get their act together in time to relaunch for next year's market. So three insurers on the market this year, not four.
Okay. So, yeah. So Dean, tell us, like, is this a sign that the Affordable Care Act is going to be left to collapse, as some Republicans have hoped and predicted?
Well, this has been a big debate for some time now. You heard during the healthcare debate, Republicans often noted that there are a number of counties around the country that that no longer have anyone offering plans on these exchanges. You know, New Hampshire with three still offering is in, you know, reasonably good shape by comparison, although we'll see what the final rate increases look like. You know, the issue has been that I think there's agreement even among Democrats that these exchanges and how they function need to be fixed or tweaked or reformed, whatever word you want to use. They did not like Republicans tying it to a repeal of Obamacare. So maybe at some point down the road, there will be some sort of a fix here. But there has been ongoing debate. Again, you can look at it through a partisan lens, sure, if you'd like, about whether or not these exchanges are really, really collapsing. And also some concern that the Trump administration might try to undercut them by not paying the subsidies that help pay for some of these plans.
Yeah, and we found out this week that the president has committed to releasing those subsidies, at least for the month of August. The insurers have basically, and supporters of Obamacare have argued, this president is trying to starve Obamacare by withholding those payments. But let's be clear here. The individual marketplace for insurance in the state of New Hampshire is not well. The patient is very sick. And that's why Commissioner Savini made those comments he made, and also why he made this unprecedented move to try and get the legislature to actually impose an assessment on all insurance companies to try and write down the individual rate increase down to 30%. Down to 30%. I mean, some of these providers who are remaining in the market have proposed initially rate increases of up to 45% for some of their folks.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction is there was one question about whether these providers were going to be in the market to begin with. But now there's that other question about which, you know, this is where it really matters for patients and for people who are getting their insurance is how much is it going to cost? And, those prices are still being finalized. You know, we saw proposed rates. A lot of them included double-digit premium increases, but those are still subject to change. I think that's going to be finalized in the next several months or so. But it's right now, if I were getting my insurance through that, I would definitely be kind of, bracing
right.
For
and
a yeah.
Even as a sign of just how polarizing this is, there's an argument even over why there are these rate increases. Is it a function of the internal logic of the markets that is flawed, or is it the political uncertainty being driven by the Trump administration? And that's another debate that's been going back and forth, but it does seem like there will be some reasonably significant rate increases if we believe what we've been hearing so far from these companies.
Mm-hmm. And Medicaid, too, of course, is an important part of this picture, Medicaid expansion. Starting last year, the state was supposed to pick up some of the tab for Medicaid expansion, and the state came up with a way to cover its share of the money, but there are problems with that. Casey, you've been reporting on this. What did the state come up with as a way to pay for this, and why is it problematic?
So the key here was we have to remember this was a Republican-controlled legislature where the idea of using state money to fund Medicaid expansion was unlikely to get support. But you did have a cohort of Republicans who were in favor of Medicaid expansion because they thought that it was a good deal financially and just generally for the state because it helped to avoid other steep costs elsewhere through emergency care and other parts of the healthcare system. So the plan was to, instead of using state money as the sole provider of that state share, they would ask hospitals and insurers to cover the state's share of costs for Medicaid expansion. And what that basically involves is there's, some taxes in there, but also just kind of a pot of money that is collected on a kind of, I think, quarterly basis from hospitals around the state by an outside organization, and then that outside organization pays a lump sum to the state. So the way state officials describe it is they don't know how much any individual hospital is contributing. This is also, not transparent to the public, but that theoretically, to hear the state's side of it kind of, protects them from saying, okay, we're like, holding these hospitals on the hook directly, or we're creating kind of undue incentives for hospitals to pay into the program that they're then going to be benefiting from. So that's kind of the long and short of it. And the federal government raised concerns about whether that was okay, basically, because of what I just said in terms of the potential kind of conflict of interest and the rules around that at the federal level.
And is the federal government sort of demanding that a new system be put in place?
Yes, but they are giving the state some time. And I think Kevin did some reporting on this in terms of when, all of the warnings were issued to the state, because there are some conflicting accounts of when and how severe those warnings were. But basically, this only just came to light within the last week. Governor Sununu's office released a letter that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services had issued to his administration, which basically gave the state until the end of 2018 to come up with a new plan. And that has, some benefits for the state in that they were already going to be having to come up with a new plan for Medicaid next year anyway, because recall, we've been reauthorizing this on an every 2-year basis, and next year is when we would have had to reauthorize it anyway. So that just kind of raises the stakes for what was likely to already be a contentious political debate over this next year.
And I do think that the whole experience with the attempt to repeal and replace Obamacare at the federal level has given Governor Sununu kind of a new appreciation for how difficult tinkering with expanded Medicaid in the state is. He was kind of much more vocal about potentially doing away with it or significantly reforming it in some way, block grants, you know, what other a variety of ideas coming out of Washington. And I've just sort of noticed over the last 6 months after that experience of the repeal and replace debate, he seems a little more comfortable with the idea that he's going to have to figure out how to keep this moving forward, because there are, you know, tens of thousands of people in the state who depend on it.
50,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be speaking about the controversial new set of daycare rules that were postponed recently. We'll also talk about the Manchester VA and animal cruelty laws in the state. But first, let's go to the phones and let's talk to Lynn in Lebanon. Lynn, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Well, hey, good morning. I think there's been a lot of good discussion on this whole equivalency thing with Trump. And while I do understand they're both sides, I just wanted to remind people that the white supremacist side has never been peaceful. Like, maybe they had some permits and maybe they started out as a peaceful demonstration, but it's not that long ago that they were burning plantations and hanging black people from trees or gassing millions of Jews, you know, in Germany. And even at this, you know, demonstration that started out peacefully, there were Ku Klux Klan signs and swastikas all over the place. And it's not very long that these people are going to be peaceful, you know, as was shown by, you know, the girl that was murdered at the demonstration.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, I've heard your perspective before. It makes a lot of sense. But let me ask you how you might respond to what the common retort is, which is that, well, Black Lives Matter demonstrations have been violent as well. How would you respond to something like that?
Well, I think violence in any demonstration is bad. When you look at the Women's March after Trump was elected, it was like incredibly peaceful. There was no threat of violence. I would say it's a complicated issue. I mean, I think there's more justification. I would think perhaps for the black people who have been pushed down and hung by trees and shot by cops, I understand their frustration better. But no, it's not acceptable on either side. And within the black community, I mean, the leaders, Martin Luther King and some of the other black leaders have had differences, right, on the level of violence necessary. So this is not my area of expertise.
Certainly, but we do appreciate you lending your voice to this conversation. And of course, as we do move on from elements of the conversation, Charlottesville, of course, big in the news. You can continue to chat about this on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Lynn, thanks again for your call. If anybody else wants to weigh in on this or other stories, please give us a call. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us exchange at nhpr.org is the email. Let's move on to daycare. A set of controversial new child care rules that were due for a vote this week have been postponed at the request of Governor Chris Sununu and DHHS. Casey, you were reporting on this. What changes were proposed?
So there were a lot, and I am going to just stipulate that I cannot recall all of them offhand. A number of them would have instituted new limits on screen time for kids, so how much time kids could spend in front of a TV, in front of an iPad. I do believe that within those rules, though, there were exceptions for, you know, if the kid was actually engaging in like an educational game or something like that. There were other additional requirements for how the daycares were supposed to keep track of, I believe, like absenteeism or other paperwork. That basically, you know, the pushback that you heard from child care providers was that these are onerous and they're going to add to costs on an already expensive industry. And anyone who is the parent of a kid in daycare, certainly from what I've heard, will attest to the fact that it is a very, very expensive portion of a family budget. I talked to one woman last week when I was doing some reporting on this, who said that she basically, like, she's treating it like a second mortgage, basically. Like, it's a lot of money.
It's like a second mortgage.
Yeah.
As you were saying that, that's what I was thinking.
So cost is a big deal here. I guess just for the sake of kind of outlining the timeline, I'm a little bit late to this reporting on this, but the discussions around this started a few months ago. There were public hearings. And then more recently, what was supposed to happen was there's a committee called the Joint Legislative Committee on Administrative Rules, JELCAR for short. And they meet on a monthly basis to basically go over the rules that are required. Like, the legislature passes laws, but then in order to carry out those laws, the agencies need rules for how to do that. And JELCAR kind of oversees the approval of those rules. So the daycare rules were supposed to be up for a vote actually this week, and those rules were to some level a reflection of some of the public comments that the agency had received. But there was some concern that the final version of the rules didn't take into account all of the opposition and all of the concerns that had been raised. So the agency, the Department of Health and Human Services, along with the governor's office, which was somewhat unusual, intervened to ask for those to be pushed back indefinitely. So the child care rules right now are not going into effect for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and they're significant for the daycare industry, and this is a big issue for them. But there's a bigger issue at play here, and there's a power play saga going on. I mean, the chairman of the Rules Committee, John Regan, a Deerfield Republican, has been very upset at this governor for essentially, in his view, interfering in the legislative prerogative. Even in New Hampshire, it's pretty unusual for one conservative Republican to say this about another conservative Republican. This is Regan about Sununu. I've been in this business for 12 years. I've never seen a governor do this. All of a sudden, we have a governor who thinks he's the legislator. I don't know what he thinks. I don't know why he does the things he does.
That's you quoting Regan.
That's me quoting Regan, okay, talking about Sununu. And this, like I said, Regan pushed back when new governor Chris Sununu asked for a 90-day freeze on all new rules. Regan said at the time, I don't like new rules either, but this governor doesn't have the power to impose a freeze. This is our job. So we're seeing some of this, and it's not too surprising, particularly – keep in mind, we not only have a new governor, but we have a new governor who's never been a legislator. And so, as we've seen, he's had some real legislative victories this year. There's no argument about that. He's also had some missteps in which he stepped on legislative protocol before. And certainly Senator Regan is saying this is another example of that.
And so give us a sense, like, what is the actual need for these particular daycare rules? Are there groups of people clamoring for this?
Certainly, the Department of Health and Human Services feels that there needs to be more strict regulations over daycare providers. We've seen in the news there have been some cases where we've had daycare providers closed for problems with failure to do proper background checks of employees who have inappropriately acted with children before. And we've seen that as well. And this is, in the macro level, this is part of the state government essentially saying the rubric we have of rules governing the daycare industry simply isn't comprehensive enough for us to properly police and keep kids safe.
Well, and it's also worth noting that daycare is a term that encompasses a lot of different things. So that's, I think they're trying to get a handle on how you actually define it.
All right. Well, this is the New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, and coming up, we'll still be talking about the drug crisis here in New Hampshire, movement on those stories, animal cruelty laws, Manchester, VA, and, of course, the iguana, Mr. Jingles. We'll be talking about Mr. Jingles coming up. So give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. I just like saying Mr. Jingles. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Casey McDermott of NHPR, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. And with you, call us with your questions about the week's news. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. So let's talk a little bit about those the animal cruelty laws. Governor Sununu has made some efforts this week to offer some more state protection for animals against possible cruelty and abuse. Kevin, have you been following this story?
Yes, we have. Certainly 2 months ago, animal investigators and police seized 84 Great Danes from a Wolfboro kennel owner because they were concerned. They found what they considered to be deplorable conditions at this Wolfboro mansion owned by Christina Fay and the vet's clinic. And so it's important to point out Ms. Fay is contesting the charges. Her lawyer hopes to regain control over these animals. But this governor took a look basically at the system we have in state law regulations and decided it's not robust enough. And here's why. There are really only 5 kennels in the entire state that come under current regulation. That's because kennels regulate the selling of animals. They don't regulate the breeding of animals. And that's what this proposed legislation would get to, which was in the Fay Homes case, there were a large number of unspayed females that were used to breed puppies that were then transferred to other people. They weren't sold, so her kennel never came under state regulation. And it was only because of the town of Wolfboro and public health officials in Wolfboro on tips that they received, even from a former employee at the mansion, that caused them to conduct the investigation and Wolfboro police to confiscate the animals.
And does this not also, the moves by Governor Sununu, clarify a little bit who actually has to pay for the care of the animals once they're seized from an allegedly terrible situation?
Correct. Right now, it is unclear who pays for it. And what happens often is that these humane societies and or the state are off the hook. And this bill would kind of create a process for a civil hearing that within a few weeks of the seizure, there'd be a hearing to determine, and the judge would determine who should pay. Should it be the owner? Should it be the Humane Society? Should it be the state? Should it be a combination of the three?
And as I'm a longtime dog owner, it's very expensive, even when you just have one or two dogs. In this Wolfboro case, you know, you're talking dozens and dozens of very large dogs that eat a lot of food. Some of them need surgeries. It was fascinating to read about the individual's lawyer claiming that it's still technically her property and that they want to Humane Society should not be having surgeries done on these dogs to fix some of their problems. This was a big operation, multiple tractor trailers. It was a huge operation. So, I mean, that cost is a legitimate concern. But I think it is sort of shocking to people who are pet owners that this woman is making the case that she should have control of her dogs back, given what we saw, the horrific conditions at that house.
Well, Dean, let me ask you, politically, people love dogs.
Sure.
Is this a wise decision for the governor to go out on a limb and do this?
I think you know, given you know, some of the cases we've seen in recent months and years, I think taking some steps. For example, he signed this executive order to revamp the governor's commission on humane treatment of animals. There are other members, I think Jeb Bradley in the state Senate, others talking about going through the legislative process. So a lot of this stuff will get a hearing in terms of sort of the pros and cons. But I was not surprised to see him step in and move the conversation in this direction.
Understood. Okay. Well, let's move on to a different subject, which is the Manchester VA. Very briefly, we heard earlier this week that Governor Sununu signed an executive order regarding this. The Manchester VA plagued with problems. Among them, the burst pipe that flooded several floors last month and left several resources unavailable to veterans who get their care there. So, Kevin, bring us up to speed. What was this executive order all about?
Yeah. As you pointed out, there was a serious flood, which is actually, if you go by the Manchester VA facility, you'll see these big, they almost look like portable classrooms, and they're actually mobile units where medical procedures are provided in the parking lot. And so Governor Sununu took one look at that as he's been investigating what's been going on at the Manchester VA and said, we've got to do something. And this executive order is pretty aggressive in doing something. It essentially says that these folks who need care can get care in any hospital for the next 8 months, essentially while Manchester VA gets back on its feet, makes an estimated $7 million in improvements to the building in light of this flood, so that all their facilities can be used, and essentially shortens the window of licensing non-VA providers from a period of many, 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 many months to a matter of a couple of weeks. These other facilities can get up and running and accept VA clients. And we saw in Manchester, to their credit, that the Catholic Medical Center really stepped up here. When this happened right away, the Catholic Medical Center administration approached the VA, came up with an agreement essentially saying, look, we'll take your folks and we'll perform whatever procedures you used to perform in-house and can't perform in-house right now while you try and get things settled.
Okay. And then, of course, there's a town hall meeting in Rochester next week for veterans who are who have questions or concerns about what's going on. And has anybody at this table been to a veterans town hall meeting? Yeah. Has anyone been to one before and after all this Boston Globe stuff and the flooding stuff?
I was before. I was there during the rollout of the Choice program, and there were a lot of questions, a lot of people who were very interested because they have a personal stake in ensuring that they get access to health care. So I think they, in my experience, have always been very robust discussions with a lot of people who, are not afraid to ask questions that need to be asked.
Mm-hmm.
And you have staff. You also have staff and patients. I've been to town halls since this crisis occurred. You also have patients and staff that really have an affinity for this facility and think the care they do provide, while is very humane, very compassionate, very supportive. Many of these same folks acknowledge their facilities need to be upgraded and that changes need to be made. And as we saw, the VA secretary, when he came to Manchester, David Shulkin actually left with a commitment to spend $30 million at that facility. And he and completely changed the leadership of that facility because he concluded this place, like he put it, is doing some good work. But sometimes you need to clean house and sometimes you need to overhaul a facility to meet the modern day needs, and that's what they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Two of those three people who were removed, they're still on the payroll within the VA system, and it's unclear what their status is exactly. They're doing some work for the regional office, but they're still in the system despite the objections of some of the whistleblowers who, as you said, there was some concern among veterans and employees of the hospital that the hospital would be merged with White River Junction, which is a full service hospital. But now there's also a push to make Manchester what is considered a full-service hospital, meaning more services for veterans and of course, more resources. But that's still, if at all, a long way off. Want to touch base on another issue, but while we still have time here on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, is the drug crisis. The city of Nashua and Manchester, actually, considering lawsuits against drug makers. Casey, you've been reporting on this. What are these cities hoping to gain?
Yeah, so just as a point of clarification, so Nashua is not, they are still only considering retaining a law firm to represent them in a possible lawsuit against opioid makers. Manchester, on the other hand, voted a few months ago to retain a law firm to that effect. And I spoke with a lawyer from that firm who is representing the city earlier this week who told me that the city is likely to file its own lawsuit against a handful of drug makers, basically kind of along the same lines of what the state did a few weeks ago. But it is important to note this will be a separate lawsuit if it does happen. And the lawyer that I talked to from this New York-based firm who represents a number of other cities and counties in New York and West Virginia and Ohio that are also part of this kind of wave of opioid lawsuits that we're seeing across the country, he said that they feel that it's really important that the cities and counties are represented on their own because they are closer to the problem and because they really, in his words, know how the money needs to be spent. So what they're basically looking for is compensation, damages to cover a lot of the kind of costs that they've incurred as a result of the crisis.
Mm-hmm. And Kevin, you've been reporting on something else having to do with the opioid crisis, which is that AmeriCorps volunteers here in New Hampshire sort of helping out with the drug crisis. What exactly are they doing?
Yeah, this is a new wrinkle. Starting in November, actually, 16 AmeriCorps volunteers are coming in New Hampshire to help fight drug addiction. They're doing it with Mary Hitchcock Memorial Hospital up in the Upper Valley. They're going to provide care that healthcare workers are too strapped to provide. That could involve like finding housing for folks or work for those in recovery. Because that's what we've seen as not only as the body count has gone up in this opioid crisis, but well, look at Safe Station in Manchester, where it's over 2,000 folks who have visited there. Meaning the existing healthcare system has been just so overwhelmed by the number of people, which is a very good thing, coming in for recovery, that more and new players are needed to augment the existing system. And that's what the AmeriCorps is trying to do here.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you know, looking at the numbers that have been released for opioid overdoses and fatalities, it looks like we're going to be up again sort of in the high 400s as we've been the last couple of years. It was fascinating for me to read that prior to 2014, it was unusual to even reach 200, and now we're getting close to 500. The other interesting thing that's coming out of this is we're increasingly seeing that fentanyl is a prime contributor. Most if not all of the fatalities involve some element of fentanyl, not just the heroin. So, you know, we've been talking for some time now here on the Roundup about a lot of the steps that are being taken federally and locally, and we're still kind of waiting to see, as you were suggesting with the Safe Stations, if these numbers start to decline a little bit over time.
Yeah, we have on our website, I put together these graphics that we've been using to track the data. So if you're looking for kind of more details on the overdose deaths in New Hampshire, I would encourage you to go to nhpr.org. But one of the things that stood out to me is that a lot of us, myself included, kind of mistakenly keep referring to this as a heroin crisis. And if you look at the data from this year, there is not a single death that has been processed this year that is the result of only heroin. There are a few that have been the result of heroin and other drugs, but for the most part, 70% of the deaths that we've seen this year have been caused by fentanyl. And the rise in overdose deaths overall in New Hampshire has correlated over the last few years with that kind of sharp rise
which
in fentanyl
a
that we're
powerful,
seeing.
A powerful painkiller, basically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what does this say that we're on track for roughly the same number of deaths in New Hampshire due to opioids? Is it that the political solutions we've implemented have been ineffective, or is it that the intensity of the problem has increased in concert with whatever solutions we've thrown at it?
I think it's important to note that addiction is a something that takes a while to recover from. So you can, I think no matter what, it's going to take a while for us to see a reversal of the trend that we've seen, because it takes people a while to get the treatment that they need, get their lives back on track. These are human beings, and it's a medical condition. So it needs to be treated as such. And it's something that requires kind of ongoing solutions that are going to that need to be implemented on the long term. So it's not something where, like, we can just throw a bunch of money at it one year and it's going to be over.
And Kevin, you mentioned the Safe Stations program in Manchester, mm-hmm. and that, you know, upwards of four digits people have been using this. Is that some measure of success of the program?
Yeah, to a certain extent it is. It's important, back to Casey's point, is folks at Safe Stations see someone coming in for recovery, short-term recovery, keeping in mind that we still need a long-term recovery system that's robust. We don't have one right now. But they've seen folks come in six times, seven times, the same person showing up for recovery. I think we have to point out, too, why is this lasting so long? It's because the bad guys are good at what they do. And by that, I mean the dealers, as folks try to recover from addiction, the dealers know, how do they keep people hooked? By chasing the higher high. So that's why you see on the street higher and higher amounts of fentanyl put in these mixes that are being sold on the street in order to keep addicts still interested, because they're going to chase something even greater. And as we saw at the beginning of this year, that's what led to carfentanil being introduced, an elephant tranquilizer being introduced onto the streets of Manchester, Franklin, and other cities. These are the dealers. They're trying to protect market share, and they're willing to kill more people in order to do it.
One other thing that happened this week was that the city of Manchester launched a pilot program to ban smoking in public parks. Kevin, this was an effort to combat the use of spice, synthetic marijuana, that is pretty dangerous. What are law enforcement officials saying about spice and Manchester parks?
Yeah, they're essentially saying that folks have been very creative and secretive about smoking in the parks, spice, which is a synthetic kind of marijuana. It can no longer be sold in New Hampshire stores, but it's very easy to obtain right over the border in Massachusetts. It's actually advertised here. So there've been a lot of complaints about smoking in parks, cigarette smoking in parks. So the Manchester police came to the Board of Aldermen and said, we want to ban smoking in all parks. There was a lot of pushback by the aldermen. Well, what about having a cigar in a Deerfield Country Club while I'm playing a round of golf? So what they came up with is a six-month ban in the four most populated downtown city parks, as well as the Stanton Plaza, which is also kind of a public meeting space downtown. Two of these parks are the places Manchester police said these people who smoke spice and try and make it look as if they're having a cigarette, that's where it occurs. So they're happy with that kind of ban.
All right, Kevin, well, thank you very much for filling us in on that. This has been the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. My apologies, everybody. We're not going to get to Mr. Jingles today. That's a shame, but we did get to many important stories this week. And remember, the conversation continues online at NHPR's Facebook page or The Exchange's Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. You can check it out there. You can always send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org. Thanks to everybody who's been here. Thanks to NHPR's Casey McDermott, the union leaders Kevin Landrigan and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU. I'm Peter Biello. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm, and our theme music is composed by Bob Lord. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you on Monday.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.